Eat, Drink, Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, indie. Welcome to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, we've got a best-of sort of show that really gets to the heart of our mission here, to explore the food and beverage scene in central Indiana, what the chefs, the farmers, the food artisans, and the beverage professionals are doing right now. And there truly is so much happening. This week, we'll hear from a local rising star chef who's doing a series of pop-up dinners. We'll talk to an artisan cheesemaker who's creating award-winning products. And we'll talk to a farmer who's tackling the issue of food deserts. And we'll check in with a craft distiller in Bloomington and a coffee shop owner in Indianapolis, both of whom are pushing the beverage scene forward. So stay with us for lots more here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. I think you can safely say that there has never been a better time to dine out in Indianapolis than right now. The city and its chefs and restaurants are getting national attention, and here locally, diners have more restaurant choices than ever before. They also have new options for special dining events, like pop-up dinners from local chefs. These one-time dinners often feature a specific theme or take place in an unusual space or include out-of-town chefs. The idea in all of these cases is to offer the diner a unique experience. To that end, local chef Alan Sternberg of Cerulean Restaurant in Indianapolis, a 2016 James Beard Award semifinalist for Rising Star Chef of the Year, along with his wife, Audra, have created a pop-up dinner series called Common House. I talked with Alan and Audra about coming up with the Common House concept and what diners can expect at a Common House event.
Last year, I got a couple opportunities go travel around a good bit and cook around the country. And by around the country, I mean like four or five states.
Right.
But more than I had before. I got to meet some really cool people and, you know, got to see some different things. And I think there's a level of excitement when new things come about or when you just don't have the expectation and then you stumble upon them. There's always something rewarding.
So you cooked at the James Beard House in New York City. You did some dinners in other states with other chefs.
Yeah.
And that makes a difference?
It totally does. Each new place you cook in has their own challenges. And trying to figure out the best way to work with those challenges and not knowing the equipment, not knowing the people you're cooking with and trying to collaborate amongst yourselves and seeing different perspectives, you know. And I think so much of the time I get focused on my perspective because that's the only perspective I know. But, like, when you start to see other people's perspectives, it kind of just says, oh, man, we should take a step back and look at a bigger picture here.
You know, how they do things and their point of view, that sort of thing?
Yeah, for sure. And so one of those epiphanies was – in St. Louis, some of the chefs there were kind of stirring the pot a little bit by doing these dinner series outside of the restaurants and really kind of challenging the status quo. And, I mean, St. Louis has a great food scene, but it just kind of dawned on me as, like, I felt like I was waiting for people to ask me too much instead of going and doing on my own and realizing how much fun I could just have.
Creating a special series of dinners on
your
own.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I love what I do at the restaurant, and it's definitely my main focus. But there's things I can't do there because, you know, our restaurant has 100 seats, and,
sure,
you know, there's P&Ls we have to be accountable for. And, you know, once we remove some of those constraints, it kind of frees me up quite a bit to experiment and play and really kind of grow for me instead of, you know, just for the restaurant.
So how would a pop-up dinner series help you do that? What's freeing about that?
It, again, I mean, I'm not really accountable to anything as long as I don't lose money. I mean, Audra and I kind of agreed from day one is, you know, this isn't really about making money. This is about, you know, covering our costs at most, really.
And growth, personal growth?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Audra's been a lot more involved in the restaurant lately. And, you know, we saw it as a way for us to work together and to grow both as a couple and professionally. And
well, Audra, tell me what it's been like creating or helping to create a new pop-up dinner series.
Oh, man. First of all, it's just exciting to do it with your husband.
So exciting.
It's fun to watch him get excited in a different way than just day to day from the restaurant, and that it's contagious. And so I get to see more of what he does in a different level and work with him, and it's just brought us closer in a different way. I mean, we work at the restaurant together, but this is more about being creative with him.
So now tell me about the first one, the first dinner that you held. Where was that? How was that?
So it was at Wildwood Market in Fountain Square. And it's a very small place. So if you've ever been there, it's a very small market. So we had to basically create a dining room because there's shelves everywhere now. So we made a very intimate dining feeling of it. You know, when you walk in, there's just one giant table. And it was very communal, so everybody sat around talking. You could be right there with them through the whole dinner. There was Alan. I was right there. And you got to just look around at each face and see everyone having a really good time. And that's what is special.
So what was the reaction? The first one was certainly sold out, right?
It felt like you went to dinner at someone's home. It felt like you were at a friend's house. People were sharing stories. Talking across the table. We had a farmer there that we were using their meat, Kyle Becker. So he could tell stories about his animals. You know, they got to ask questions. It was a mixed bag of people, but everyone found something to talk about, and that was really special.
Well, now tell me how a pop-up series works, kind of the nuts and bolts of it. It's a ticketed event, right? And people sign up ahead of time.
Yeah, yeah. So right now we're just using Eventbrite. We looked at a couple different places as far as how we could sell tickets to the event, and Eventbrite was the most user-friendly for us.
Mm-hmm. So people can go online and look for it?
Yep. We just started a mailing list, an email list, so we can announce. We're not going to announce a dinner until the day after we're done with one.
Right.
Because I think we sell a dinner short if we try to conceive too far ahead.
So that you can experience the one that you're into at the moment,
yeah.
Right?
And you know, it comes down to the whole, if I plan something 6 months from now, and hopefully I'm in a way better place than I was, you know, now. You know, hopefully I'm doing better stuff, and my level of thinking is at least marginally better.
So it would be, yeah. It'd be completely different then.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's... No, I look through my old books and my notebooks, and I just look at some of the ideas. I'm like, what was I thinking?
so you can see your progression.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I do that with the menus too. You know, between the restaurant and different events, and you know, looking back through Instagram or Facebook or whatever, I'm just like, ugh. A lot of cringeworthy moments for myself there.
So what about, this seems to be part of growing the infrastructure that you talked about, developing the dining public, kind of bringing them along with you. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we talked fairly recently about, you know, the city has grown so much. And, you know, I feel like in a way we've all kind of pat ourselves on the back and said, you know, we're there. And
we have gotten a lot of attention lately.
We have got a lot of attention. And I think part of being there is continuing to go and continuing to push and not, you know, relishing that victory, but at the same time, set new goals. And for me, this was setting a new goal, you know, a new year, a new goal. And so far, I mean, we've we've been able to accomplish a lot in really a short amount of time, and I want to keep that going. I don't want to ever fall down. I'm going to fall down, but I don't want to get burnt out and slow down and not want to push and not want to keep getting better. You know, if I can do one little thing better each day, you know, over a lifetime, I'm going to be pretty good at something.
We've been talking with Alan and Audra Sternberg of Common House, a new pop-up dinner series in Indianapolis. For more information, check out commonhouseindy.com or look for it on Facebook. We focus a lot here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on chefs like Alan Sternberg of Cerulean Restaurant and Common House in Indianapolis, but talking with artisans like cheesemaker Fawn Smits of Tulip Tree Creamery is also key to exploring the area's growing food scene. The interest in artisan food here in central Indiana continues to grow, and the products you see at local farmers markets certainly speak to that. One of the foods you'll see at local markets is cheese. Mild chèvres and mozzarellas, soft, ripened cheeses, even what many refer to as stinky cheese. The demand for all sorts of artisan cheese has grown so much over the years, and cheesemaker Fawn Smits has been a part of that growth here in central Indiana. First with Trader's Point Creamery near Zionsville, then with Ludwig Farmstead Creamery in Illinois, and now with his own Tulip Tree Creamery in Indianapolis. I talked with Fawn recently about his fascination with cheesemaking, his travels around the world, and how he launched a creamery in Indianapolis.
Yeah, Tulip Tree, we are in production about 2.5 years right now. So officially we were founded December 2013, but we made our first cheese and we sold our first cheese in June of 2014. And it's been 2.5 years and it's been going great.
Well, now tell me a little bit about your background. You've been part of the Indianapolis local food scene for a long time, right?
Yes, I think for Indianapolis right now since 2003. Been in here in Indiana. I've been in the dairy itself. I've been for over 25 years. Yeah, my background is I graduated in Holland in a dairy institute for food technology, specialized in dairy science, and then started traveling the world a lot, you know, and got my work experience like that. Worked in Africa for 5-6 years, worked in California for a couple of years, and did a lot of consulting in other countries like Mongolia, you know, Uganda, Malawi, Ukraine, China. So a lot of different places.
Did you know you wanted to do that? Was it something you always wanted to do?
It fascinated me. That was the key thing. And I think part of it, because I grew up in this tiny little village, you know, we had about 2,000 people there living in a village called Koudam in the southwest corner of the province of Friesland in the northern part of the Netherlands. And everything was surrounded by dairy fields, you know. It's a pasture and lots of dairy farms. A lot of my friends had, you know, were growing up on dairy farms. So I spent a lot out there. I didn't grow up in a farming family, but it always fascinated me to see what's going on. And I was always passing by this big dairy plant on my way to the bigger cities, and always wondering, so what's going on in there? And that was my first experience, having my first practical training for 6 weeks working in a dairy plant. It was the biggest one, and it was just fascinating. And I usually played a lot and fished a lot behind the old dairy plant, which was in our village, which closed down and everything. Same thing, you know. I was fascinated by, you know, we have all these animals and we're making all these products and all these cheeses go everywhere. And that was a key thing for me. And then apart from there started the whole fascination about, see, what's other countries, what do other cultures do with these products, you know, what do they make? And I wanted to find that out, and I thought, you know, what is a better way to do that but traveling and working and get that experience like that? So that's how it all started.
Now, it's kind of universal, but then different, you know, because I assume that the cheeses in different countries are very different from each other. Did you see similarities and differences all throughout the world?
Yeah, there were a lot of different things. It's fascinating to, you know, going into a place like Mongolia, and you go to a market and they have all these dishes of milk, you know, or like made from different animals, you know, from camel milk, cow's milk, you know, yak milk. They have all these different animals, and it's kind of in an open market. And that's where I found out too, like they were making candies out of milk. And it's, you know, and but also products like cheese, of course. And it's nice to see how that is. So there's a lot of similarity between these countries because they make similar style products. But then again, it's fine-tuned to fit the climate where they are. And that was always great. I really enjoyed that. And then working in those kind of cultures then, and then see how can you, you know, help to make a certain product a little bit better. That was a key thing for me in Africa, where we, in Tanzania, when they were making a kind of a local buttermilk drink, let's say, a culture drink, which was traditionally was nothing more than milk getting sour. Of course, that was not the healthiest thing always. So what we did was then, you know, culture that in a very specific way and process it in a specific way, that you got this really great product, which we called Mtindi. And it was so good. People were eating that. They were drinking it, or they were using it with their meals. And yeah, and then that was just great. That was quite something to see, you know.
How do you end up in Indiana, though, after traveling all over the world? What brought you here?
It was very much a coincidence. I was working for a consultancy company in Holland, an international consultancy company, and everything looked great. You know, we got this house in our village, so that looked perfect. And then suddenly, after 2 years, the board of directors dissolved the whole company, and I was looking for another job. And in Holland, things are a little bit different. Even if you have a lot of experience, it might not always be so easy to find a job. And since my wife is American, we said, okay, you know what? Let's take a look at America. Let's look at the U.S. I always wanted to have a small creamery. And, of course, starting in Holland, a small creamery is, you know, you compete with a lot of them. So it's very difficult. So then, but here, it's a whole different market. So that made it very interesting. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, you know, we had this little creamery here in Zionsville that was Trader's Point at that point, wanted to start up. And they said, hey, you know, we're looking for somebody. They had a friend who was from the same province as I am, in Friesland. And they said, hey, you know, we're looking for somebody. And at that time, I just went through those people too, where they send the fax. And within 3 months, I was over here and we talked. And I think in August, we started. And that was 2003. And, you know, and 3 months turned into 5-6 years. And now it's like 2017. So
that's probably where people might have first met you, with Trader's Point Creamery. Yes. And then saw your career grow from there. So how did the progression go from there?
Yeah, so I started with Trader's Point in 2003. I worked before that. I worked in California already for Calgill Creamery, and I worked for a Dutch cheesemaker in California as well for a year. It was Bulk Farms at that point. Now it's Oakdale Cheese. So that was great. And then after Trader's Point, I handed over my work, and then I said, you know what, I want to go more independent. I want to go more on my own. And that's where I helped another creamery to start up in Illinois, which was the Ludwig Farmstead Creamery. Did that for 3 years. And
we've probably seen that at the farmers markets as well.
Yeah, those products too. And, you know, since we were living in Zionsville, and we're still living in Zionsville, so our focus was first to say, okay, how can we sell those products around here? Made it a little bit easier. So we started that one up, and after 3 years of driving up and down, I thought, okay, that's enough. And during that time too, I did a lot of private consulting. I helped a lot of small other creameries in the U.S. And I had this little thing in my head, you know, where it's like people were asking me to say, when are you going to do your own thing? I've been helping others with different products, new product innovation, and solving issues and all that. And so they kept asking me, I say, when are you starting your own thing? And after a while, it became so much. And then I thought, okay, well, we don't do it now. And then, you know, we better never do it. So I thought that was in 2013, 2014. And so, okay, let's do it. You know, everything came together. It was like the perfect timing. We got a good loan from the bank, and that's where Laura, my sales manager, and I said, okay, you know, let's do this. And Eileen, my wife, said, okay, yeah, if you don't do it now, then never talk about cheese again, something like that. And we went with it, and it has been great. You know, we really worked on those. We wanted to do something different with the products which we wanted to make. I've been making all those big wheels, So we wanted to do something very special. The cheeses which you don't really find around here, and kind of cheeses of, you know, different regions, different countries of the world too. So that's how we came up with all these little different cheeses. The washed rind cheeses, or the stinky cheeses, how people call them. The nice bloomy rind cheese, the triple cream, like our Trillium. We have something more like an Alpine, like our Haymates, with the little wheels. So we have all these different styles of cheeses, which we're now putting out. And yeah, I think it's great. You know, that's, we really want to do that.
We've been talking with Vaughn Smith of Tulip Tree Creamery. In addition to meeting local chefs and food artisans here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, we also talk with farmers about issues facing the industry. Hancock County farmer Jonathan Lawler of Brandywine Creek Farms tells us about his work to help alleviate hunger and get fresh produce to those who need it. The subject of food deserts is a major concern for those in the local food community. The fact that some of us simply do not have access to fresh food can be startling. And to realize that the problem hits those in rural communities just as it does for those who live in cities, well, that was a surprise for Hancock County farmer Jonathan Lawler. But his realization that there was hunger in the midst of his rural central Indiana community prompted him to do something about it. Last year, he put acreage on his own farm into production, growing fresh produce, with the thought that he could help address the hunger problem in Hancock County. After investing their personal finances into getting started, Jonathan and his wife Amanda formed Brandywine Creek Farms, and the project began to grow in a big way. In fact, in its first season, the farm grew more than 200 tons of produce, more than 400,000 pounds. And this year, the goal is to grow even more. I talked with Jonathan, founder and executive director of Brandywine Creek Farms, about how the first season went and about his plans to do even more this year.
It came about from my son telling me that there was a classmate of his that was taking home food from the food pantry at his school. My son goes to Eastern Hancock, mm-hmm. which is...
So you're in a rural area.
Very rural. A lot of the trophies that you see displayed at Eastern Hancock, you know, have to do with agriculture.
FFA and yeah. things like that.
And they even have cattle there on campus. So
you're in the middle of a farming community.
Right. And I was just, you know, kind of taken aback. And I told him that he was probably mistaken. Mm-hmm. He was probably taking it home from the cafeteria for whatever reason. And he said, no, we have a food pantry. So I actually Googled it. And
did you to look it up?
Yeah, and they did. And then I talked to the principal. And, yeah, they have a full-functioning food pantry that serves about 46 families.
In a rural area in central Indiana.
Yeah, yeah. So I started looking at a couple of farms. I actually watched a documentary called A Place at the Table. It talked about food insecurity. And I remember there was a teacher that was working in a school that was passing out food, and she goes, you know, I would love to be taking them fresh fruits and vegetables, but that's not what we get donated. We get donated boxes of processed food. So I talked to my wife, and, you know, we talked about maybe planting an acre or two for that pantry. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what if we turned all 36 acres at, you know, addressing the lack of produce? And she thought it was a great idea, and that's how we got started.
So the problem is that even in rural areas, there are food deserts, fresh food deserts, surrounded by corn and soybean fields.
Absolutely. They can actually be somewhat worse than the ones in the urban areas because, you know, an urban area considers that if you're not within a mile of a grocery store, you know, mm-hmm. you're in a food desert. Well, in the urban areas, it's 7 miles.
In the rural areas.
In the rural areas. Yeah, it's 7 miles. And if you don't have transportation in the rural areas, you're not going to get there.
There's no buses.
There's nothing, you know. Yeah.
No cabs, no nothing.
I mean, in these small towns, there's Dollar Generals that have apples that I wouldn't give to my hogs, you know, for sale. You know, that's what they have there. And they're expensive.
Right. So you don't have very much of it, and it's expensive.
Right. So we got with cleaners, we got with some other people and talked about it, and we decided let's address this for central Indiana.
Now, you weren't aware that this was an issue until your son kind of brought it to your attention?
I had no idea that. I was so ignorant to hunger and what hunger looked like. I was one of those guys that if I went to cleaners and seen overweight kids standing in line, I'd go, well, he's not hungry. He's not hungry. They're not hungry. You know, they're overweight. How can they be hungry? And when I heard a doctor speak on it at a TED Talks, and he actually said in the United States, our poor, our food insecure, have a shorter lifespan than that of people that are food insecure in third world countries because they develop disease, heart disease, diabetes. I listened to a local doctor here talk about she doesn't use the term adult onset diabetes anymore. She just calls it type 2 diabetes because now it's affecting children. Yeah,
children and young people are affected by it.
Right.
So what was your reaction, you know, as a family to this?
Not everyone likes to talk about that, for one. It was surprising to us. I mean, it was very surprising to know that there were people that were my neighbors that were hungry. I mean, we have a soup kitchen. We looked at that like, well, maybe that's for the elderly that have trouble making their own meals and things like that. And it wasn't until, you know, we really looked at the rural aspect of it. And then within central Indiana, within the city of Indianapolis, my idea of hunger was someone that was underneath a bridge in downtown Indy.
So how did you go about doing that? So the idea was to start by raising some fresh produce for food pantries.
Correct. So, I mean, I just started my farm up again like we did every time, except we weren't planning on selling any of it. So we were, you know, that was a leap of faith for me and my wife.
Now, how can you do that? So explain.
Well, we drained our personal savings doing that. But we had a couple of people come forward and say, hey, you know, you should really, you know, look at this from a nonprofit aspect. Here's a farm in New York that's doing what you guys do.
An example for you to look at.
Yeah, look at what they do. And I actually reached out and talked to them, and the guy was super awesome. It's called Matthew 25 Farm, and they're in upstate New York. And he talked to me for like 4 hours on the phone.
Oh, that's great.
And just told me everything that I need to think about and, you know, the volunteer aspect, you know, raising funds, who I should target to sponsor the farm. And then we had a lady in our community. She's actually a city council member. Her name's Keely Butram, that came forward and said, you know, if you guys are going to do a nonprofit, I've sat on a bunch of boards. I know how to do this, by all means. You know, I'd love to be your first board member. So, yeah, Keely became our first board member and has been instrumental in helping us grow that part of the business.
So did you have any experience in this sort of not-for-profit management at all? Tell me a little bit about your background.
No. Farming and transportation,
okay.
Trucking. So, uh-huh. Yeah. So zero when it comes to that. So.
And you weren't daunted, you know, at the scope of the concept?
Daunted is not, you know, I would say disappointed after learning that the nonprofit side is very business driven. You know, it's not a bunch of, you know, we're doing this for the betterment of humanity. I mean, there are, that's the majority, but there are, you very much find the people that are like, this is a business.
Right. So, you know, so you found yourself in the midst of creating a not-for-profit, to address the problem. How'd that go?
Well, I mean, we still don't have our 501c3 status yet. I thought it was a matter of, you know, paying an attorney, filling out the paperwork, and the IRS gives you that. No, that's not the case. It can take 18 months. So
we did
that last summer, and we're hoping that our 501c3 status will, you know, our attorney's saying best case scenario, June.
But so. You went ahead and you had an awesome year last year.
Yeah, we raised 420,000 pounds of produce.
That's a lot of produce.
We had a lot of great volunteers come out. All three of my sons easily put 70 hours of work in a week on the farm. I personally put that much work in on the farm. Our other board members stepped up, and they were, I mean, people that have no experience on the farm were out working on the farm.
You had some community days as well, right?
Yeah, we had a planting day where everyone came out and planted. What was great was we had a lot of grain farmers, their kids that came out and helped, not knowing anything about produce, and then realizing, wow, this is completely different. It's another animal, and They actually kept coming back and volunteering, so that was super awesome about that. Our hospital kind of heard about what we were doing
in Greenfield,
mm-hmm. Hancock Regional, and we went to them and they said they'd like to sponsor our season because it's, you know, the health benefits of what we were offering were great, and they stepped up and sponsored us, and we actually found a fiscal agent that could take tax exempt donations for us. And we were able to get in touch with some great people here in Indy and then some people outside of Indiana that stepped up and helped fund us.
So what did you raise? What kind of things did you grow last year?
So we grew tomatoes, sweet corn, green beans, actually not green beans, yellow wax beans,
okay.
Peppers, cucumbers, zucchini, and watermelons.
Now, were you guided by what the pantries wanted to receive, or
nope.
did you just kinda...
I told the pantry I wasn't growing the things that they were wanting. They were wanting carrots and potatoes.
Okay.
You know, like hearty root crops.
Right.
And number one, potatoes, you know, an argument can be made that that's not exactly the healthiest thing somebody should be eating anyway. But what I did tell them was that I will give you this stuff that it'll have at least a week shelf life, if not more.
Okay.
You know, it's not like they're used to these donations of things getting ready to go bad.
Because they've traveled, for one thing, from California or Mexico, perhaps,
right.
and then gotten here and then gotten to the food pantries. So.
Right. So that was the easy part for us. We, you know, we were able to explain to them, this is picked now. I mean, it's got a week before you got to get rid of it. So
sure.
if you pick it up on Friday, if you have it distributed by Monday, you're good. So gleaners really stepped up. I mean, we had a truck on call anytime we needed it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, yeah. It was perfect. So
what was the reaction in the community? You know, did people buy into what you were doing?
I think a lot of people did, especially in Indianapolis. You know, there was other people that were just kind of, for a long time, I mean, we would have people stop by the farm and be like, well, you know, we see everything you're growing on Facebook. You know, we want, you know, a dozen ears of corn and, you know, how much is this? You know, well, we don't sell it.
Oh, you're right, because that's not the model. You're
yeah.
not raising it
yeah.
for a farm,
I mean,
stand, right?
Right. And we had restaurant. I mean, I had a produce broker, you know, come to the farm in a truck ready to make a large purchase. And I'm just like, we don't do that here. And he left a little bit, you know, frustrated. But yeah, we had a great response from people. I mean, we had everyone from you know, disabled Iraqi vets to you know, persons on house arrest that were allowed to come to the farm, you know, out, you know,
helping work the farm,
you know, and harvest. So it was great.
Now tell me again how much you raised.
We raised 420,000 pounds approximately. So
that's a lot of produce.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
We've been talking with Hancock County farmer Jonathan Lawler of Brandywine Creek Farms. The craft beer, wine, and spirits industry is a big part of the area's beverage scene. And we've talked with a variety of local brewers and distillers and winemakers. Adam Quirk of Cardinal Spirits in Bloomington tells us how he got started making craft spirits. The craft cocktail scene and its focus on artisan spirits has certainly taken off here in central Indiana, and it's spurred the development of craft distilleries, small artisan operations that are making handcrafted spirits. That's just what's happening in Bloomington, Indiana, where Adam Quirk and his partners at Cardinal Spirits have released more than 24 different varieties over the past 2 years, with more on the way. I talked with Adam recently in Bloomington about how he came to be operating a distillery, what it was like to launch 2 years ago, and where Cardinal Spirits is going from here.
We're about 2 years old. We opened in February of 2015, but I've been actually thinking about Cardinal Spirits for like 7 years. So when I moved back here from New York in 2010, I met my business partner, Jeff Wuslich, and we started thinking about starting a distillery. You know, it took us a few years to kind of write the business plan, and so 2013, we wrote the business plan and raised some money. In 2014, we built out the distillery. And then finally, in 2015, we opened. And we've been up and running for a couple of years now.
So why a distillery? How did that How did that present itself as a possibility?
Well, there were no distilleries in Bloomington, which was kind of amazing. It's a college town. We have heard that people like to drink here. And so we knew that there was a market opportunity. And then just aside from that, you know, Jeff was really interested in spirits since he was, you know, basically of drinking age. He never really liked beer as much as he liked spirits and cocktails. And I came at it from an infusions background. I just, you know, since college, I've been infusing cheap booze with fruit and spices and things like that to try to make it better. When you don't have a budget, you have to kind of get creative. So I've been doing that for, you know, 12 to 15 years, something like that. So we came at it from different angles, but we both just had a passion for creating something with our hands and trying to use local ingredients to make something awesome.
So now tell me what you make at Cardinal Spirits. How many varieties of spirits are there?
So I think we've released 14 different products at this point, everything from vodka to whiskey and everything in between. I would say, you know, we definitely focus on unaged spirits at this point just because we're young. We do have stuff sitting in barrels, but it's not ready yet. And no whiskey before it's time is our motto. So we have vodka, we have gin, we have a great black raspberry bramble, which is a flavored vodka. We have a couple liqueurs. Our Songbird coffee liqueur is great. A flora, which is it's a botanical blend of hibiscus and jasmine and elderflower, and it's a great liqueur as well. So just a whole wide variety of stuff. We really have we focus on sort of intense flavors so that you don't need to add much to this to make a great cocktail.
Now, how do you come at the idea of you know, accepting the fact and pitching it to people that, hey, I'm going to open a distillery? You know, how do you get to that point?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. It was a challenge, I think, to get people over the hill then when we were pitching this as a new business. But people were interested in the space because craft distilleries are fairly young. The industry is fairly young, but there's a good you can see the trend line already where it's getting ready to start picking up, just like craft brewing did in the 80s and 90s. So I think people were interested in just getting in the industry at an early stage, just like we were. And then, you know, the other piece of that, honestly, was just the marketing side. We have great branding, and we had a good plan for how to make this thing successful. And I would say, you know, half of the investors were more interested in that, the business side and the way we plan to operate, than they were the actual juice in the bottle, you know. So it helps that our stuff is delicious, but from a financial standpoint, it's not as important, actually, as, like, the operations and the planning that went into it all.
So what was the idea? How is your marketing different, or, you know, what makes it special?
Well, you know, what makes us different, I think, from a lot of other distilleries is that we do produce everything from scratch and by hand. The vast majority of vodka and whiskey that you see on the shelf is actually not made by the company that is on the label. And that's unfortunate, but we know that consumers these days are much more educated and interested in actual handmade produced products. And so that was really our pitch. We're going to do this right. We're going to make it from scratch because neither of us were interested in starting a marketing company. We wanted to make something, you know, and so that's what we're doing. We buy raw ingredients. We ferment them here in site. We distill it. We bottle it. Everything happens here instead of buying neutral grain spirit or, you know, barreled whiskey or something.
So it all happens right here in Bloomington, like completely from scratch.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we bring in raw ingredients from all over the place, but everything that actually, you know, everything that gets produced happens in this building, in these 4,400 square feet.
Now, what was it like when you opened? Kind of describe that just a little bit.
Yeah, that was pretty crazy. I had a maybe 5 or 6 month old kid, and Jeff had a maybe 2 month old. So it was a hectic period of our lives, one that I think I have some post-traumatic stress from. But opening week was crazy. The first night we sold out of our vodka.
Now, how does that happen, that you completely sell out?
Yeah, you know, we underestimated demand, which is, you know, always a good thing. So yeah, around 9 or 10 o'clock that night, we just had to stand up on the bar stool and say, "Everybody has to go home. We have no more vodka. You drank it all. We will make more. Come back some other time."
So that was the first spirit, right? Was vodka?
Yeah, yeah. Vodka was our first one. We released a gin shortly after, and then yeah, they just kept cranking out after that. I had several recipes all ready to go before we opened. From my, you know, days of home and basement infusions. Yeah, we rolled out, I think, 11 spirits the first year we were open.
That seems like a lot.
Yeah, it is. It's nuts. I mean, for a distillery, that is excessive, you know. For a brewery, that's totally normal. You know, they can crank out small batches really easily, but usually distilleries are, you know, you're talking about two or three products a year, if that.
So what was the thought on rolling out so many options?
Well, so twofold. You know, we have a cocktail bar here as well. And so our bartenders were kind of tired of just drinking, you know, playing with vodka. We wanted to give them a full bar as fast as possible. So we had all these spirits and we put the schedule together and we just started cranking them out. You know, that takes a lot of planning on the back end, because you actually need to plan a lot of research and development time, and then you have to let it sit in the bottle for a while to make sure that nothing happens. And so it was insane. It was an insane year.
Where do you go from there when you've opened a distillery, a cocktail bar? Where do you go? I mean, are there more spirits you want to launch? You know, are there some that you have made that you don't want to make? You know, how do you keep making more?
Yeah, so from here, you know, we have a great cocktail bar. We do tours of the distillery every weekend. They're almost always sold out. It's a great place, and we love it here in Bloomington. I think next steps for us is expanding our distribution footprints to the Midwest. So we're in Kentucky, and now we're in Chicago and Nashville as of basically 2 weeks ago. So we're launching distribution in other states. We're doing that as slowly as we can, though, because we want to make sure that we're doing it right instead of just sort of the shotgun approach. So we're picking our markets, making sure we can spend time in the markets and to support our brands, you know, teach people about it. The education is a big part of craft spirits, and it's a big part of what we do as, you know, owners and our event staff, is going out and teaching people how to use this stuff.
We've been talking with Adam Quirk of Cardinal Spirits in Bloomington. Like other aspects of the food and drink scene, coffee culture is growing in central Indiana. We've covered our regular latte art barista competitions and the caffeine crawl events. And we recently talked with Chris Kalander of Caffeine Coffee about that shop's global focus. As with the local restaurant community, the Central Indiana coffee scene continues to grow. We're seeing more and more roasters, and the appreciation of artisanal or third wave coffee continues to grow as well. And that creates room for a variety of different coffee shops. Caffeine Coffee, owned by Chris and Amanda Kalander, focuses on coffees and coffee drinks from around the world. I stopped in at Caffeine Coffee, which is tucked away in a bit of an industrial area just off Massachusetts Avenue, and talked with Chris about the backstory of Caffeine Coffee, from its coffee truck beginnings to the world of coffee you can find at the shop.
The backstory of Caffeine is I've been doing coffee for a good time now, at least 18, 20 years. I helped run a couple coffee shops. I've designed a few coffee shops, or more than a few. And so everything from, you know, water systems to espresso machines. And then about 2008, after a few health issues, we decided to open up a coffee truck. So around 2008, I started actually building it out. Took me a little while to get the truck going. So I think we were on the street around 2010, roughly. And
now, what was the atmosphere here around 2010? What were you experiencing?
Well, in coffee, there wasn't much at all at that point. There were your typical coffee shops. There was definitely no third wave coffee yet. There was not a lot of people. There wasn't any artisanal roasters, I should say, or if I could call them that. There wasn't a lot of artisanal shops. There were your your straightforward coffee shops. I think that as far as the truck scene goes, we were just getting into the truck scene. We had West Coast Tacos, I believe, on the streets, and we actually just had, we didn't have a whole lot of rules on trucks at that point. I think Mark Mitchell was one of the original guys that was helped write some of the rules for food trucks. So it was kind of an open scene at that time. We were just able to go where we wanted and do what we wanted. And so that was fun times. We actually could take the truck downtown. We would open up and serve coffee at events, parties, festivals. So that's where we really got our feet wet as far as our menu items. So we were really developing our special blends of beans that we use for our caffeine blend, and a lot of people were loving it. We saw the response through the truck, and then we, at that point, we were starting to introduce new drinks as we were experiencing ourselves. So whether it was, you know, an Italian Bicherine, or whether it was an Antochino or things like that, those were all drinks that we were starting to implement on the truck.
So where did it go from there? You know, what was the progression?
Yeah, the progression of the truck was, I mean, we saw an influx at that point of people really loving what we were doing with coffee. So it was at that point we almost said, you know, the truck is a great thing, but it's also a great marketer. So the idea of that being the full bread and butter, we wanted a much bigger picture than that. We wanted a place that people could come and sit down and experience coffee. So it was at that point that we decided that we need to look for a location. We had gone through a couple different locations, a couple places that we hoped or thought would work out. Those locations didn't work out, but we happened to come upon our current location at 707 Fulton. So it's a great area. It's still kind of an industrial area. I kind of compare it to the Meatpacking District of New York, where Stella McCartney came in and kind of revitalized the area, and restaurants started coming in and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of see this area as people like it and they're drawn to it because it's industrial, but yet it's still so close to Mass Avenue.
It's, you know, what people would say is off the beaten path, certainly, but still kind of right in the middle of everything.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that people like the idea that they're, because, I mean, it is an area that people still like to walk. I mean, you know, we have Indie Fringe at the end of the street, and we have apartments right across the way from us, which are just right off of College. And I think that those people love the idea. And actually, true, we have a lot of doctors. We have a lot of people from the hospital who may come in, grab their stuff, and go. And people come and just meet friends. So I think that it is a good location to stop, grab, and go versus having to maybe sometimes fight some of the parking issues that you may see.
And you are right off of the highway, you know, so it's an interesting little area.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I think that that's one thing that is kind of getting this end of Mass Avenue going, is that it is so close to the interstate, and that, you know, it's almost like it's being developed as now the entrance to Mass Avenue versus the opposite end of Mass Avenue.
Now that's interesting, because you know you're down sort of toward what would people would see the end of Mass Ave, but maybe it's the beginning.
Yeah, I think it may be. Just from some of the knowledge that I have received lately, is that you know we have the new the Credit Union parking area and we've got some of the restaurants on this corner, but you know, and hopefully this intersection will change obviously for traffic purposes, but I think that we definitely see that this may be kind of the new entrance of Mass Avenue.
So as even our perceptions are changing about the area and how people use it and interact with the area, how are things changing with how people view coffee here in Indianapolis?
Well, I think coffee is definitely finally getting the limelight it deserves. I think that, you know, especially what's happening with the food industry, you know, we see a lot of awards going, coming to chefs and whatnot. And for that matter, I think, I'm an artist, I went to art school, but so I'm always one to push the envelope. So to see the food industry being pushed, I definitely still see there's room to push coffee, which is what we're trying to create, bring that edge to coffee, or bringing a new level to coffee. But I definitely see that the city in general is really doing a better job of bringing coffee to the limelight in the sense of matching it up. If you want to call it pairing, you can, and trying to bring it to the same level as the attitude of food that we're having here.
So that coffee is part of the culinary scene.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, in some cities, it's even much greater than it is here. I mean, you know, Portland, Seattle, I mean, those places, it really definitely is, I mean, it's intertwined.
Oh, absolutely. So as it's developing here in Indianapolis, what are you hoping to accomplish, you know, with caffeine coffee?
Well, I think the first thing is that when we, and some of the reaction we've already gotten from it is that when people walk in the door, they obviously know immediately that there's something different about it. So I think we have a certain responsibility to live up to that. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that we try to broaden the horizon as well as educate when needed, because we don't feel like we necessarily have to push it on people, but a lot of people that come to us are the type of individuals that just love to learn about coffee, you know, and there's a lot to learn. Trust me, I'm learning every day. But for somebody to come in and say, okay, caffeine's different, I hope to have a different experience, that's what we want. So we do drinks, we try to concentrate on drinks from around the world. We have what's called our World of Coffee drinks, which is if you were to go to Torino, Italy, you would get the exact same drink that you may experience in Torino, Italy, or in Madrid, or, you know, any of those drinks. So we try to really focus on the bigger picture of coffee from around the world, not just Indianapolis.
We've been talking with Chris Kalander of Caffeine Coffee. I'm Jolene Katzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning in or downloading our show today. And thanks also to our guests, Alan and Audra Sternberg of Common House, a series of pop-up dinners in Indianapolis, cheesemaker Fawn Smith of Tulip Tree Creamery, Jonathan Lawler of Brandywine Creek Farms in Hancock County, Adam Quirk of Cardinal Spirits in Bloomington, Indiana, and Chris Kalander of Caffeine Coffee in Indianapolis. And thanks to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.